طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Tom Suarez has written an important book exploring the roots of Zionism, a history largely denied by mainstream Zionists because of its dependence on terrorism to advance its agenda against the Palestinian people. The book is meticulously documented from British military archives, but despite its authenticity, Suarez is attacked almost everywhere he speaks or tries to speak. The accepted Zionist history and narrative that is proclaimed today is largely based on myth that cannot be documented from historical archives, yet those who present the documented true story, like Tom Suarez, are pilloried and called anti-Semites. It is a dark story of deceit, terrorism, and the exploitation of Jewish refugees and Holocaust survivors. Our feature presentation this morning is Tom Suarez discussing his book, State of Terror, How Terrorism Created Modern Israel. He spoke at the Palestine Cambridge Forum at the Argyle Street Co-op in Cambridge, England.
Thank you all so much for being here, and thanks to Dave for saving the day. Quickly, I'd like to express my gratitude to Jenny Hardacre, Avril Parkinson, the Cambridge Palestine Forum, and everyone else who made this meeting possible. And my thanks to Carl Saval, my publisher, Radha Carmi, who many of you may know, who was the inspiration for my book, and my partner, Nancy Elan, who could not be here tonight, but who was my constant alter ego throughout my research. Research that I confess was often very upsetting for the level and relentlessness of the violence and cynicism it revealed. To begin, three quick points. One, just to say it, all forms of racism and bigotry should be uncompromisingly condemned. Anti-Semitism is one of them. The definition of anti-Semitism is the same as for any other brand of bigotry. Anti-Semitism is hatred against Jews because they are Jews. That is a complete, unabridged definition. Anti-Semitism is, in fact, central to our topic, but not in the way those who undermined our open meeting at the Friends Meeting House would have us believe. More about that later. Two, you will hear the word Nazi in context of Zionism, but you will hear this only when I am quoting voices from the World War II period. Now, in contemporary discussion, I think making this parallel is an unhelpful distraction unless there's some specific reason for it. When, however, well-informed observers in the early 1940s, including Jews, made such comparisons, I think we need to hear what they said. And finally, I am aware that some of what I will say here tonight may be considered contentious, so just to say that the source for everything I will say is cited in my book, State of Terror. Most of it is taken directly from declassified source documents held by the National Archives in Kew. Although I will be speaking mainly about the pre-state period, our ultimate topic is, of course, the so-called conflict. And the only reason I should be taking your time here tonight is if I believed that I might have something constructive to offer toward the collective efforts towards peace. So, an explanation of my thinking. To me, for years, looking at this situation, what is striking above all else, and I think what is preventing peace, is that reality, truth, facts, knowledge, have no effect, as though Israel-Palestine exists in an alternate universe. And so no attempt to bring peace will succeed until we address the reasons for this, which I believe begins at Israel's narrative, its creation myth. As painted by this narrative, Israel is not merely a political entity like any other nation state, but morphs into the Old Testament kingdom whose name Zionist leaders adopted for that strategic purpose, striking a powerful chord in the collective Western subconscious. That messianic narrative had to be inseparable from the nation state, and to accomplish this, Israel encapsulated it into a three-word self-identity, the Jewish state. Make any attempt to address the so-called conflict, you will instead hit this three-word human shield, consisting of Jewry itself and all that goes with it, that the state hides behind. This self-identity is qualitatively distinct from any other country's relationship with any other religion or cultural group. Judaism is not Israel's state religion in the sense of a national faith that any nation might adopt. Rather, Israel, exploiting the classic anti-Semitic notion of Jews as a tribe, a race apart, presents itself as the Jewish state, the metaphysical embodiment and owner of Jewry itself, of Judaism, Jewish history, culture, and persecution. No country claims it is, just to use one example, the Catholic state. Costa Rica is a Catholic state. It does not suggest that it owns Catholicism, Catholics, or historic Christian martyrdom. We do not have the British government issuing guidelines as to when criticism of the Costa Rican government becomes anti-Catholic hate speech, nor some political pressure group masquerading as a charity smearing us in the next day's Daily Mail. Nor does Costa Rica claim an exclusive franchise on Catholicism. Several nations maintain Catholicism as a national faith. Israel, in contrast, would never acknowledge even the possibility of another Jewish state because it holds Jewry hostage to shield its actions from scrutiny. Thus, Israel, taken at its word, makes Judaism partner to whatever is done in its name, and the profound anti-Semitism of this is self-evident. Zionism was, of course, among the incarnations of racial nationalism that evolved in the late 19th century. Bigots were Zionism's avid fans. For example, Gertrude Bell, the famous English writer, traveler, archaeologist, and spy, reported, based on her experience, that those who supported Zionism did so because it provided a way to get rid of Jews. Theodor Herzl, the original champion of political Zionism, was horrifically anti-Semitic. He described traditional, that is, non-Zionist Jews, as a hideous distortion of the human character, something unspeakably low and repulsive. And it goes on like this. This was the father of political Zionism. Most Jews, of course, had fought for equality and resented being told that they should now go make yet another ghetto, and worse yet, on other people's land. They resented being cast as a separate race of people, as Zionism demanded. They had had quite enough of that from non-Jewish bigots. The year 2017 is, of course, the centennial of the British original sin in this tragedy, the Balfour Declaration. What is irrefutable in British records is that Balfour and the other officials involved knew that the Zionists intended to seize all of Palestine and expel non-Jews from it. Most active at the time were Chaim Weizmann and Baron Rothschild. They demanded that their Zionist state extend all the way to the Jordan River by 1921 and then expand beyond it. They already treated the ethnic cleansing of non-Jewish Palestinians as indispensable to their plans and insisted that the British lie about the scheme until it is too late for anyone to do anything about it. In correspondence with Balfour, Weizmann justified his lies with racist slurs against the Palestinians and against Jews, that is, the Middle East's indigenous Jews, who were overwhelmingly opposed to Zionism and whom Weizmann smeared with classic anti-Semitic stereotypes. The Palestinians he dismissed as, in so many words, a lower type of human. And this was among the reasons he and other Zionist leaders used for dismissing simple democracy in Palestine. if the Arabs, the Palestinians, had the vote, he said, it would lower the Jew down to the level of a, as he put it, native. With the establishment of the British Mandate, 4 decades of peaceful Palestinian resistance had proved futile, and armed Palestinian resistance, which to be sure included terrorism, began. Whereas Palestinian terrorists were loosely knit groups operating outside the villages, the Zionist terror organizations operated from within the Jewish settlements in Palestine and were actively empowered and shielded by those settlements and the Jewish Agency, the recognized semi-autonomous ruling body of the settlements, what would become the Israeli government. These Zionist terror organizations attacked anyone in the way of their messianic goals, Palestinian, Jew, or British. And there was no substantive difference between the acknowledged terror organizations, most famously the Irgun and Lehi, the so-called Stern Gang, and the Jewish Agency and its terror organization, the Haganah. The Irgun, in particular, would act on behalf of the Haganah so that the Jewish Agency could feign innocence. The Agency cooperated, collaborated, and even helped finance the Irgun. The Jewish Agency tolerated little dissent and sought to dictate the fates of all Jews, and the indoctrination of children was thus vital to the Zionist project. The extremism of this first came to public light on the 8th of July, 1938. On that day, the Irgun blew up a bus filled with Palestinian villagers. Now, this was not the first time the Irgun had done something of this sort. But this time, the British caught the alleged bomber. She was a 12-year-old schoolgirl. Indeed, Jewish teenagers, both boys and girls, were commonly used to carry out terror attacks. Teachers were threatened or removed if they tried to intervene in the indoctrination of their students, and the students themselves were blocked from advancement if they resisted. Jews who tried to oppose and warn of the emerging fascism were assassinated. And indeed, most victims of Zionist assassinations, that is, targeted rather than indiscriminate, were Jews. From the beginning of World War II, late 1939, through to the summer of 1947, that is, right before the partition resolution, there were virtually no Palestinian attacks, even though Zionist terror against the Palestinians continued. A British explanation at the time for the Palestinians' refusal to respond in kind was that they understood that the attacks were a trap intended to elicit a response that the Zionists would then frame as an attack against which they would have to defend themselves. Indeed, this was a Zionist tactic alluded to by the British as early as 1918. And it, of course, remains Israel's principal strategy today. Terrorize until there is a reaction, then broadcast that reaction as an unprovoked attack. To be treated as most secret is the red ink heading of the transcript of a key meeting of 20 people, including the top Zionist leaders, held in London on the 9th of September, 1941, setting the direction for Palestine's future. It is worth citing from this meeting because it is typical of what went on behind the scenes, for example, in Jewish Agency meetings, because it proves that the so-called Biltmore program of the following year, 1942, though it sounded extremist at the time, was actually a toned-down public version of the truth. It is midway, almost exactly midway between the 1917 Balfour Declaration and the 1967 enlargement of the 1948 occupation of land beyond the 1947 partition. And finally, because it is an almost comical laying bare of the hypocrisy of Zionist, now Israeli, claims of democracy and equal rights. Indeed, the conversation sounds like it presages George Orwell's then still-to-be-written Animal Farm. Present were Weizmann, who had called the meeting, David Ben-Gurion, and other Zionist leaders, such as Simon Marx of Marx & Spencer, and the prominent non-Zionist industrialist, Robert Whaley Cohen. There is no ambiguity. The takeover and ethnic cleansing of all of Palestine was always had been, and remained the plan. Anthony the Rothschild began by stressing that there would be no discrimination against any group of its citizens in the so-called Jewish state, not even to meet immediate needs. Weizmann and Ben-Gurion also assured the skeptics, Arabs, Palestinians, would have equal rights. However, they clarified, after much of this, they clarified that within that absolute equality, Jewish settlers would have to have special privileges. So Weizmann's, quote, absolute equality required the transfer of most non-Jews out of Palestine, while permitting, quote, a certain percentage of Arab and other elements, whatever other elements is, I don't know, to remain in his Jewish state, the insinuation being as a pool of cheap labor. Anthony the Rothschild's vision of equality and non-discrimination was equally compelling. It, quote, depended on turning an Arab majority into a minority, and to achieve this first step, there would be no equal rights for non-Jews. Cohen, the industrialist, found the scheme terrifying. He submitted that the Zionists were, and I quote him, starting with the kind of aims with which Hitler had started. He proposed, instead, that the state not be predicated on race or religion, and that it be named with a neutral geographic term. He suggested Palestine. The others were horrified at this idea, arguing that if the state did not have a Jewish name, quote, they would never get a Jewish majority, acknowledging the use of messianic fundamentalism as a cynical political strategy for the benefit of the settler state. In another obvious but never publicly spoken admission, Ben-Gurion clarified that his Jewish state was not based on Judaism. It was, rather, based on Jews as a race, which until Zionism had been classic anti-Semitism. Asked about the borders of his settler state, Weizmann continued in the same surreal manner. He replied that he would consider the partition plan proposed by the Peel Commission 4 years earlier, in 1937, but that the line, the partition, would be the Jordan. Now, this was nonsensical. The Peel Commission's eastern border for the two states was the Jordan. So Weizmann's partition meant 100% for the Zionists and 0% for the Palestinians. And he went further still. He would, he said, very much like to cross the Jordan. That is, take Transjordan along with Palestine. At the end of the meeting, Weizmann sought to put his proposals into effect officially in the name of all Jews. Those against his proposals were, in his word, anti-Semites. Meanwhile, World War II was raging. What was the Jewish agency's reaction to the most terrible enemy Jewry has ever known? From the beginning, it was to lobby the Yishuv, the Jewish settlers in Palestine, not to enlist in the Allied struggle against the Nazis, because doing so would not serve Zionism. Even taking advantage of May Day, 1940, that's a half year into the war, to lecture the Yishuv to stay put in Palestine rather than help the Allies. It was to conduct a massive theft ring of Allied weapons and munitions, as if, as one British military record put it, paid by Hitler himself. It was to continue its violence in Palestine, taking resources and personnel away from the war effort. And after the Allied victory, it was to exploit the fact that Britain's economy had been devastated by the fight against Hitler. It pressured the U.S. not to approve its post-war loan to Britain unless Britain acceded to Zionist demands. Much has been written about the collaboration between the Zionists and the fascists during the war, the best known, of course, being the Havara Transfer Agreement that broke the anti-Nazi boycott. One of the least known was Leahy's attempted collaboration with the Italian fascists. In its nearly concluded Jerusalem Agreement of late 1940, 1 year into the war, in exchange for Leahy's support in the war, the fascists would use their military power to destroy any Jewish communities not in Palestine, which was most, of course, and force their populations to Palestine. If this sounds like a scheme so extreme, that only fanatical Lecky could have conjured it, it is essentially what the Israeli state ultimately succeeded at in the early 1950s, most catastrophically, when it conducted a false flag terror campaign against Jews in Iraq to destroy that ancient community and move its population to Israel as ethnic fodder. German Jewish immigrants to Palestine during the war were outraged by the Zionist cynical exploitation of the Nazi horrors they had just fled. This outrage was given voice by, among others, the prominent journalist Robert Welch. He had been editor of a Berlin newspaper until that paper was banned by the Nazis in 1938. Welch warned that Zionist leaders, and I quote him, have not yet understood that the enemy, the Nazis, seeks the destruction of the Jews. We, who have been here only a few years, we know what Nazism is. Zionists, rather, are, quote, taking part in the crash of European Jewry only as spectators. Now I paraphrase, fighting the British and keeping Jews from joining the Allied struggle while getting comfortable and rich from their political project in Palestine. Recent immigrants from Germany and Central Europe, he said, have no representation among the Zionist ruling establishment. If they did, quote, we would have demanded that the Yishuv should put itself at the disposal of Britain for the fight against Hitler and Nazism. But, and to be clear, I am still quoting him, they do not want to fight against Hitler because his fascist methods are also theirs. They do not want our young men to join the forces, the Allied forces. Day after day, they are sabotaging the English war effort. These German Jewish immigrants were shunned by the Zionists, their publications and presses bombed. Even kiosks were bombed by the Zionists for selling non-Hebrew papers to German Jewish immigrants. In 1943, a man whom British records describe as, quote, a Jew whose integrity is not open to question, risked his life to warn about the threat of Zionism. For his safety, he was referred to only by the code name Z. Z described Zionism as a parallel movement to Nazism. He warned that the Zionist indoctrination of Jewish youth was producing a society of extremists who will use any method necessary to achieve Zionist goals. And he pointed out that as fascism in Europe has demonstrated, such a society is very difficult to undo once it has taken root. The result, I'm afraid, is what the Palestinians face today in the so-called conflict. How trustworthy is this anonymous testimony? Well, I found at the National Archives a private letter in which Z is identified. He was J.S. Bentwich, the senior inspector of Jewish schools in Palestine. A report by U.S. intelligence in the Middle East, dated the 4th of June, 1943, was entitled Latest Aspects of the Palestine Zionist Arab Problem. And note, it did not describe it as a Jewish Arab problem, but a Zionist one. The report described Zionism in Palestine as, quote, a type of nationalism which in any other country would be stigmatized as retrograde Nazism. And it stated that anti-Semitism was essential to it. Whereas, quote, assimilated Jews in Europe and America are noted for being stout opponents of racialism and discrimination, Zionism has bred the opposite mentality. Quote, a spirit closely akin to Nazism, namely an attempt to regiment the community, even by force, and to resort to force to get what they want. The report refuted Zionist propaganda already prevalent about having, in so many words, made the desert bloom. It noted the irony that it was from the Palestinians that the settlers learned, among many other things, the cultivation of the Yaffa oranges. And whereas the Palestinians were self-sufficient, the Zionist settlements exist only on massive external financing. And should the settlements ever have to survive on their own merits, as the Palestinians do, quote, the venture will collapse like a pricked balloon. The conclusion of this early U.S. intelligence report was, however, naive, or at least it was premature. Now that the world, quote, has seen the lengths to which the Nazi creed has carried the nations, it reasoned that the Zionists, quote, are due to find themselves an anachronism. Unfailingly, Jewish suffering served the Zionist project, not the other way around. In fact, the single most deadly terror attack of the entire Mandate period was not the bombing of the King David Hotel in 1946, as is commonly said. Even some of the Irgun's bombings of Palestinian markets killed more people than the King David attack. But the single most deadly terror attack was the Jewish agency's bombing of the immigrant ship Patria in 1940, killing an estimated 267 people, most of whom were Jews fleeing the Nazis. Now, the Jewish agency bombed the Patria because it was bringing the DPs to Mauritius, where the British had facilities for DPs and where they would be safe. The Zionist version of history is that the agency meant only to disable the ship. But this is an absurd argument. When you blow up a ship, you cannot then say that you didn't need to hurt anybody. The fact is that the agency placed its need for ethnically correct settlers above the lives of the people in order to get the survivors to remain, which indeed they did. In further violence against its Jewish victims, the agency framed them for their crime and exploited them for propaganda. It spread the lie that the DPs themselves blew up the vessel, that they committed mass suicide because they could not bear not to go directly to Palestine, posthumously exploiting the very people they had killed to serve the Zionist myth. And this, by the way, was not the only Jewish immigrant ship that the Jewish agency bombed for its own political reasons. Another form of Zionist violence against Jews was the sabotaging of safe haven in order to force them to Palestine. The best example I can offer is that in early 1944, President Roosevelt succeeded in principle in establishing a 500,000 new homes for European DPs, most of these homes in the United States and in Britain. U.S. Zionist leaders were outraged and sabotaged the program. When Roosevelt's aide, Morris Ernst, confronted these U.S. Zionist leaders in an attempt to save the program, he was, in his words, quote, thrown out of parlors and accused of treason. Why treason? Treason because Morris Ernst was Jewish and the Zionists owned Jews. To be sure, I am not saying that the international community were welcoming to European DPs. The issue, rather, is that the Zionist movement as a whole used its considerable influence to keep the doors shut, not to open them. Nor were those already settled safe. In 1946, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Palestine, Yitzhak Herzog, conducted a massive kidnapping operation of orphans of Jewish background who had been adopted by European families when their parents perished years earlier. Removing 10,000 children from their homes was the number he freely cited to the New York Times as his goal. In the National Archives, I found a copy of his own record of this trip. In it, Herzog complains of the fierce resistance he made from horrified local Jewish leaders who tried to protect the children. But Herzog used his political clout to circumvent them. In France, for example, facing the steadfast refusal of Jewish leaders to betray the children, Herzog, and I quote him, demanded promulgation of a law which would oblige every family to declare the particulars of their children in houses, now I paraphrase, so that those of Jewish background could be exposed and put back in orphanages until they can be shipped to Palestine. Quite a Kafkaesque twist on Passover for these children who had just been spared the Nazis. Herzog's justification for the kidnappings was that for a child of Jewish background to be raised in a non-Jewish home is, quote, much worse than physical murder. Yet even this bizarre justification fails to explain what was actually taking place, because at the same time Herzog was rescuing Jewish orphans from this fate much worse than physical murder, his Jewish agency colleagues were sabotaging Jewish adoptive homes in England for young survivors still in the camps. The real reason for all of it, of course, was that the children were needed to serve the settler project as demographic fodder. To that end, the Jewish agency had coerced President Truman to segregate Jewish DPs into Zionist-run camps. Despite objections, even from fiercely pro-Zionist Churchill, that it echoed Nazi behavior, the camps nurtured such fanaticism that it shocked a joint U.S.-UK committee that visited them in 1946. Before these camps, few Jewish DPs wanted to go to Palestine. But now, the committee found these same DPs in a delirious state, threatening mass suicide if they did not go to Palestine. Even the offer of new homes in the United States, which had always been the favored destination, was now suddenly met with threats of mass suicide. DPs were also groomed to bring Zionist terrorism to Europe, bombing Allied trains and Allied facilities. The bombing of the British Embassy in Rome in 1946, for example, was by DPs brainwashed in these camps, as was a near catastrophe in the Austrian Alps in 1947, when DPs nearly blew an Allied train off a steep trestle into a deep abyss, which would almost certainly have sent its 200 civilians and Allied troops to their deaths. After the war, the Jewish agency discussed its enemies. They were democracy, the Atlantic Charter, which of course became the basis for the United Nations, Reconstruction, and the fall in anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism having always been Zionism's drug, without which it would be irrelevant. The agency sought to exploit anti-Semitism and blamed what it saw as declining anti-Semitism in the United States on what it called America's democratic attitude. As Henry Hunlock, the defense security officer in Palestine, reported, it was important for the Jewish agency to stir up anti-Semitism in order to force Jews to come to Palestine. Now, today, when anything approaching this topic is raised, it is twisted by some into the pejorative misstatement that the speaker, in this case me, is blaming Jews for anti-Semitism. No, rather, it is the fact that Zionism requires anti-Semitism and seeks to ensure that it, or at least the appearance of it, never ends, and this at the expense of Jews. I also mentioned Reconstruction. As one former settlement member, a man named Newton, explained, Zionist leaders were afraid that with the improvement of conditions in Europe, the pressure on Palestine would subside. Indeed, Ben-Gurion initiated a policy of non-cooperation with Reconstruction even before the war ended, beginning in 1943. By 1946, Zionist terrorism had become the defining daily challenge of life in Palestine, and 100,000 British troops had proved unable to contain it. Anyone or anything that kept Palestine a functioning society was a target of the Zionists. Trains, roads, bridges, communications, oil facilities, and Coast Guard stations were constantly being bombed by the Zionists. Utility workers, telephone repairmen, railway workers, bomb disposal personnel were murdered. Police, and especially Jewish police, were long a favored target of the Zionists and were gunned down by the dozens. Among the smaller terror organizations that popped up was one specifically dedicated to the Zionists' long-running fear of Jews befriending non-Jews. The ultimate fear, of course, being polluting what for the Zionists was the pure Jewish race. As a sample of its methods, the terror group is said to have doused a disobedient Jewish girl with acid, severely injuring her and blinding her in one eye. Zionist terror was aided by the Jewish agency's phenomenal intelligence network. The agency had informers all the way to high-placed sympathetic U.S. officials that fed them intelligence, such that the British government learned not even to trust direct messages to U.S. President Truman. When the UN's Palestine Committee, UNSCOP, visited Palestine in the summer of 1947, the agency had already replaced the committee members' drivers with spies, had already replaced the waiters at the main restaurant they frequented with spies, and most productively sent five young women to serve at what they called a theater network of house attendants at the building where the members, all of the men, were being housed. The young women were required to be smart and educated, but above all, in the Jewish agency's word, they were required to be daring. Whatever daring meant, they extracted a wealth of information and probably influence from the key people who were deciding Palestine's future. Jewish sex workers were involuntarily recruited as spies. They were confronted and told that upon the Zionist victory, which they were assured was imminent, that they would be executed for sleeping with the enemy, but that they might be spared if they cooperated now. The practice was so widespread that a standard questionnaire was printed up that the women were to fill out after each British customer. Illustrative of a degree to which Zionist plans infiltrated the government and everyday life, a couple of months after one Coast Guard station was attacked and bombed by the Haganah, it blew up again. But this time the British were baffled, because this time there had been no attack. They discovered that the construction crew that had rebuilt the station after the previous bombing were Haganah and had simply embedded explosives in the reconstruction. But the worst problem of infiltration was in the military service, where deadly sabotage by Zionist plants who had joined the forces led, tragically, to orders to remove all Jews from service in Palestine, because there was no way to tell the Zionists from the Jews. By 1948, this problem spread to key medical personnel. After the Jewish agency poisoned the water supply of the Acre with typhoid in order to expedite the ethnic cleansing of this city, which of course lies on the Palestinian side of partition, the bacteriologist hired by the British proved to be a Haganah plant or sympathizer, an obstacle to the availability of the vaccine. Selling terror required effective marketing. And for this as well, the Jewish agency exploited the plight of European Jews. A clear example of this is the iconic Zionist immigrant story, the USS Warfield, renamed the Exodus for the obvious biblical iconography. The Exodus was sold to the world as the desperate attempt of 4,515 Holocaust survivors to reach their last hope of safety and a new life, their promised land. The British, instead, forced them back, not just to Europe, but to their ultimate nightmare, Germany. Well, that was the story the U.S. and British public got. In truth, the Exodus was a cynical propaganda event, grand theater, not for the benefit, but at the expense of Jewish survivors. The Jewish agency knew that the Exodus passengers would be turned back, for among many other reasons, the Zionist flooding of Palestine with settlers was a tactic to force its political goals. And remember that the entire Exodus cargo of immigrants equaled less than 1% of President Roosevelt's resettlement plan that the Zionists sabotaged. The DPs themselves were products of the Zionist camps and had been rehearsed to repeat, as one witness described it, whatever Zionist mumbo-jumbo was demanded of them. As for the return to Germany, it was the Jewish agency, not the British, that forced the DPs back to Germany. Attempts were being made to find new homes for the Exodus passengers elsewhere. Denmark was one possibility. But this was sabotaged by Ben-Gurion because it would spoil the Exodus theater. There was, in fact, already an alternative to Germany. All the Exodus DPs had the right to disembark in southern France rather than continue back to Germany. But the agency used violence to prevent the DPs from leaving the ships. To paraphrase Israeli professor Edith Zertal, the greater the suffering of these survivors of the Holocaust, the greater their political and media effectiveness for the Zionists. A few months after the Exodus, the UN, violating its own charter, blocked Palestinian self-determination and recommended partition with the implicit creation of a Zionist state. The creation of the Israeli state was the direct concession to Zionist terrorism. Let me repeat that. Resolution 181 and the creation of the Israeli state was the surrender to the certainty of continuing Zionist terror against Western interests. Caving to that terrorism enabled the West to confine the victims of that continuing terrorism to the Palestinians. The alternative UN plan was for a binational state, which of course is different from one state. The Palestinians would have supported the binational state as a compromise, but this compromise would be, to quote British cabinet papers, totally unacceptable to the Zionists, and, quote, would therefore be followed by an intensification of Jewish terrorism. The disproportionately large land area the UN gave the Zionists in Resolution 181 was also in fear of Zionist terrorism. Again, quoting British cabinet papers, giving the Zionists so much land up front was an attempt to delay, not prevent, but delay the Zionist expansionist wars that they knew would come. This appeasement, of course, failed. Within a few months of Resolution 181, the Zionist armies were already waging their first expansionist war, confiscating more than half of the Palestinian side of partition. There is the sense that the situation calmed, became static after 1948. This is false. The ethnic cleansing and the terror attacks continued post-statehood, evolving with the new dynamics. Israel, now holding up the untenable catastrophe it had created and refused to rectify, as the existential threat against which it now had to defend itself. But the victims were now, with rare exceptions, just the Palestinians. This refusal to rectify its crimes was, and remains today, a complete abrogation of the agreements upon which its admittance to the UN was conditioned. 100 years ago, MP Edwin Montague, who of course was Jewish, accused the British government of anti-Semitism for colluding with the Zionists. History has proven him correct. Let's look at the reason why we are here in this room rather than at the Friends Meeting House. Obviously, Zionist pressure groups silence voices critical of Israel, or in this case, of the history of the Zionist project, to ensure that Israel can continue business as usual. These groups wield influence by claiming to speak not just for themselves, but on behalf of Jews, and implicitly all Jews in Zionism's tribal sense. Therefore, according to Zionism, Jews, as this alleged people, want, empower, and are thus responsible for Israel's actions. This is true anti-Semitism. And exposing this simple, obvious truth is, in my opinion, the conflict's Achilles heel. But, as matters stand, every time the child points out that the emperor is naked, he or she is smeared as an anti-Semite and silenced. Today, the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, promotes a definition of anti-Semitism that is engineered to shield Israel's ethnic racial crimes. What greater betrayal of the memories of the Nazis' victims? Similarly, the self-proclaimed Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, the CAA, instead exploits the smear of anti-Semitism in order to empower this pariah state in its ethnic racial crimes. This is anti-Semitic, because it explicitly implicates Jews, simply by virtue of being Jews, in the actions of the Israeli state. In closing, just to say that all this put together, to me, the prerequisite for justice in peace in Israel-Palestine is to deprive Israel of its smoke and mirrors. Thank you.
You have been listening to Tom Suarez discussing his book, State of Terror, How Terrorism Created Modern Israel, at the Palestine Cambridge Forum at the Argyle Street Co-op in Cambridge, England. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org, or listen to us later in the day or at any time via the instant archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is only on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive to hear all our past broadcasts, access truthandjusticeradio.org on your browser, truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.